Okay. Hi, I'm Justin Kapos, University of Washington. I'm here to talk to you about our Million Node Genie project. We're currently also calling it Seattle. Seattle is kind of our code name for this release. It's also how it's referred to on our web pages and most of our documentation. So they are sort of one and the same thing. Okay, the key idea that we have here, or the key thing that we're doing, is we're building an incentivized platform for resource donation. This is incentivized in that we have incentives for people to adopt it, and it's based on donation, much like things like Boink or SETI at Home or other platforms like that use resource donation so that to build their infrastructure. So Genie and NSF, they don't have to go and pay for a bunch of hardware for us. They basically just have to pay for us to write the software and to do a bit of management and things like that. So this is based very heavily on end-user opt-in, which I'm going to talk about kind of in the second part of the talk. What we're producing, our environment that we end up with that people run code in, is something like a programming language VM, but also has a lot of operating system VM characteristics and things like this. So I'm going to be telling you a little bit about our platform and showing you a quick demo of how it works in practice to give you a feel for what we've really done, and then I'll kind of come back to the end user opt-in issue. Our goals with this platform is, you know, we'd really like to minimize adoption hurdles. We want to make it as easy as possible for people to use this. We want to have as broad a set of possible adopters as we might have, and we want to make it attractive to multiple communities so that there may be more than one reason why different people would want to adopt our platform. And the current thing that we've really been focusing on, the people who we've really been trying to make our platform attractive to currently, are educators. And so the first part of this talk, where I go and I show you demo and do some other things like this, is really kind of targeted at the computer science education faculty members and people like this. So if you teach networking and distributed systems classes, I'd love to have you pay attention and perhaps use this in a class. We have had classroom use at three classes at University of Washington. We're starting our new quarter. It's going to be used in another class. And we've been used at other universities, like ETH Zurich is currently in the middle of a semester using us, and we've had interest from other people. So, all right, the key things to know, by the way, about... You can't see colors on here at all. Okay, so some of this slide is actually in red. The words incentivized and donation are actually in red on this slide, and those are kind of the key things from the perspective of this talk. Okay, and so one big question is, why the heck would we want to use donation? Why use donation to do this sort of thing? And there have been a lot of precedents that donation actually has worked really well in other contexts. So Boink and a lot of other, either projects that run on top of Boink or related projects have used donation of end-user computers, spare resources on those, to do quite amazing tasks with respect to, allowing researchers who don't have access to a supercomputer to compute very impressive things. And currently, I saw a recent paper by the people who did Boink, and they have about 500,000 computers. And so one thing to notice is they have essentially no incentive scheme other than sort of altruism and a few leaderboards and things like that. And so while getting 500,000 users is great, and having a testbed of that size is pretty good, it's taken them something on the order of 10 years to get there. And we feel we'd like to have faster adoption and better return on the NSF's money in a shorter time period. So we're actually hoping to, within about 2.5 years, to build a testbed of 1 million nodes or so, on the order of 1 million nodes. And the way that we help to speed adoption and hope to do this is by using incentives. And so currently we have incentives for adoption of our platform for educators. And the current thing that we do is we ask educators to have systems that they use or their students use, maybe in the lab, or the students can install this on their home computers to help them do their homework. And for every system that this runs on, we give them resources on 10 other computers. So there's an incentivized adoption thing where if instructors want to give assignments that require a significant amount of resources, then they need to be running this on a significant amount of resources of their own. So let me give you a quick walkthrough about how this might work. So you someone goes, they download an installer. We don't require any sort of root or administrative access or anything like this. You can run it in a very restricted account. It's intentionally meant to be very, very safe. I run it on this laptop. In fact, I'm running it right now while I'm giving my presentation. I also do banking on this laptop. I run it under my normal user account. You can put it in a restricted account if you like. A lot of lab machines have multiple user accounts, and one thing that people are concerned about is, if I install this under five user accounts, are there going to be five instances of this running? Is it going to take five times as much of the resources? And that's not the case. We detect multiple copies that run on the same machine and prevent them from using resources multiple times. Also, if an instructor goes and has an installer that's installed on a bunch of machines, it doesn't mean that the instructor's account has to be the one to actually go and acquire computers and use resources on computers all around the world. They can actually go and share those resources with students who can then go and do things. So the resources you get aren't tied to a specific account. You can share them with other users in the system. Yes. So yes, if you have a multiprocessor, multi-core machine, we will only run one copy on it. That is correct. Sorry, can you repeat your question?
All the industry is moving in the direction of multi-core.
Yes, all the directions moving in the direction of multi-core. No, we will run one instance. However, what we will do is we will use more resources on a multi-core machine than we would use on a non-multi-core machine, because you have more processor resources. We essentially try and take 10% of the resources of the system, which if you have a dual-core processor, then you'll have essentially twice the CPU that you can donate, which will allow people to run, you know, more to do processing more quickly on your system with the donated resources. I'll show a demo of this in a bit. Also, if we required every user who wanted to run code in these VMs on remote systems to have a login, it would be prohibitive. So it isn't, you know, one of the big things that the big issues that you would have that was kind of cleared up with Planet Lab is that now you essentially have an account on machines all around the world, and you can log into these machines. And you know, we would be building a very unusable platform if every person who wanted to run their code on a remote machine had to get an account there. So instead, what we do is we run something that's conceptually similar to the Node Manager on Planet Lab, and you can fire up this your code in a restricted VM on remote systems. Also, if we had very, very limited support for platforms, if we only supported Windows or only supported Linux or only supported Mac, it would be really hard for us to grow to a large size. So we support Linux, Mac, Windows, BSD. We even, to varying degrees, support some mobile devices. So if you have a jailbroken iPhone or Windows Mobile or a Nokia N800 little touchpad thing, then we support those devices and are looking, a lot of students have these and are very excited about these, and you can go and add these to the testbed as well. So the programs that run, I mentioned this before, but they're actually run in a virtualized environment on the system. And so there are a lot of concerns that this raises, having like this programming language VM. So I'm going to talk about these. If you have a bunch of diverse platforms like Windows, Mac, Linux, things like this, you may be concerned about how portable the programs that you write on the programming language VM actually are. And we've taken quite a bit of time to try and make sure that every program that you write will actually run and behave the same on any platform you run it on. No matter what the underlying OS is, no matter what the underlying OS does, it will all operate and behave the same, so that someone doesn't need to debug their program on many different architectures. You can run the same thing on a phone that runs on a beefy Linux server. Another concern that especially educators have is students might have a hard time learning how to use the environment. Students might have a hard time programming in the environment. We use our programming language VM is based on a subset of the Python language, and we've actually found that it's amazingly easy for people to use. And some students have done really remarkable things with this, with very, very little experience. I should say that I work with lots and lots of undergraduates. I had 15 undergraduate researchers working on things related to this project last quarter, and the majority of them were sophomores. And for students who are sophomores who've never taken maybe even a data structures class, don't know what concurrency, don't know what networking is, to be able to go and contribute to something like this is, I think, really a testament that it's very easy for them to learn and use. It's safe. Programs, if we weren't careful, they could pose a security risk. But our programs are checked for security, and we have a very small API that's tightly controlled. And we also have resource controls, much like you would see in an operating system VM. So there was a recent survey where they looked at the ability to do performance isolation for VMware and Xen and Solaris. And we went and ran the same benchmarks on our system, and we actually found that we were optimal according to the list. So we have basically the same sort of performance isolation that you'd see in VMware and better performance isolation than Xen and Solaris did at the time when those benchmarks were run. So let me tell you a little bit how this would commonly be used in an educational setting. So an instructor might go and set up donations on computers. They get an installer. Either they go and install it, they give it to a TA to install it, they ask the students to install it. And they get those credits under an account of theirs, and then they can go and share those credits with the students. The students also might do installations of their own. And then what the students will do is they'll go and request resources via our website and then use a shell to start and deploy programs and to go and manage the resources that they can use. They can run their programs. They can see what happened. If they made a mistake, they get a nice error traceback that's really easy for to read and debug. And if they want, they can also run this locally and run programs locally and test them out, which is really handy if you're like me and you tend to fat finger things. So when you have syntax errors and you're kind of in that state, you really don't want to go and deploy it on 20 computers only to have 20 messages come back and tell you syntax error, and then you go in and retype it and then try again and try again. So it's easier to just run it locally in the beginning. Okay, so I'm going to go through a quick demo now. This is the exciting part. This is the part where everything can go wrong. Who here has had absolutely zero problems with the network since they've been here? Okay, no one is raising their hand for the benefit of the people on the phone. Okay, so the network here is pretty horrendous, but I'm gonna give this a try. I did it in the demo session and maybe half a dozen or so times and didn't have a problem there, so we'll see if I can do it one more. Okay, we don't need to see my email. Okay, so this is our web portal. You can go here and do exactly what I'm doing, which I'm going to go ahead and register for a new account, assuming I have a network connection. Come on. Come on. Please. This is not. Oh. I have a little ping thing here somewhere. Well. I think I'm not connected to the internet now. So, oh, I really hate this. Okay, so who here saw the demo? Who here saw a demo that I gave? Okay, was it cool? It was great. Oh, something is moving. Okay. This isn't. Okay, I think I'm, I hate to do this. No, come on. It can't, I'm sorry. Oh, there we go. Okay, I'm gonna give this a try. If it takes too long, I'll have to move on, but I promise you this all does work. I do demos for this all the time. I've never had an unsuccessful demo. This has been the most drama I've ever had up at a podium with this so far. So, all right, I'm going to create a new user. Let's call it Genie Engineering Conference 4. Yeah, that's a fine username. I'll type in a password here. Once again, this is something you know any of you could do. Let's say we're Genie, and we're going to have it generate some credentials for us. Okay. We have now had our account registered. Can log in. All right, and it has gone and created public and private keys for us. I'm going to go ahead and download these. These are credentials I'm going to use to authenticate myself, much like you know the SSH keys and things will work. There's a little image over here. This looks really horrible on my screen. Let me see if that's any better. It's actually, it looks a lot worse, but it actually fits in the screen now. So this is just a little image telling you there's a toolkit here you can download. So that doesn't bode well for my network connectivity, but so normally I would, you can see here that everyone who registers account right now, we give you 10 free credits, so you can go and play around. You can get 10 free VMs to go and run your code on and do things. You don't have to actually donate resources if you don't want to right now. However, as soon as the first person writes a bot to automatically register accounts on here, we're going to be removing that. So if you want to go and try it out, you should try it out now before too many people go and register an account. I can go over here on this tab, and once again, you know, obviously our website is not so amazingly slow that it can't display a simple little HTML file in this amount of time. The network connectivity is really bad. And I can go and it has a bunch of installers here that I could use for different platforms, and I could go and download the Mac installer and run it now on my system, which would go and install it on here so that I would get have a donation. There's also a link here, and I can just send this link to anybody, and anybody who installs this, I will get credited for their donation. So an instructor could go and take this link and give it to the students, and then the instructor gets the credits for this. So this is all good and fine. Now I'm going to actually show us running a program with this. So I'm going to grab some computers, let's say 9 computers all around the world. I click the button, and this is actually supposed to take about 5 to 10 seconds, so this might not be the network. There we go. Okay, so now I have vessels on all these systems. I have my little VMs that I can go and run code in. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to open a shell that we use to access resources. And I'm going to load in the credentials that I use, or that I got for this user. Right. I'm going to go and look up the nodes that are, I'm going to look for VMs that I have access to. These are advertised in a couple of different DHTs, and so I looked them up. And of the 9 systems I got, I was able to talk successfully with 8 of them. I think the other one, the problem here is almost certainly related to my network connection. So now what I can do is, using these 8 computers, I'm going to go and tell them to run something. So first of all, I'm going to get the IP addresses. I'm going to do an all pairs ping. And what I'll do is, I'm actually going to write the IP addresses into a file. I can go through and we can figure out where these nodes are if that's of interest to anyone. It'll just take a second. About 2/3 of our WAN nodes are on Planet Lab, so you'll see actually almost all of these nodes are Planet Lab nodes, except for maybe this, whatever the heck this piece thing is. And this bottom one's probably not a Planet Lab node either, because they tend to have their reverse lookup. But you see we have a couple of nodes here in Greece, Singapore, Japan, UC Santa Barbara, Germany. So we have legitimately computers all around the world that are going to run this. Okay, so now what I can do is I'm going to upload my list of IP addresses that I'm going to use to do the all pairs ping. And now I'm going to start my all pairs ping program. One thing that we did as sort of a convenience for instructors, so who here has had problems with network ports on shared machines when you have students? Yes, this is a problem. So what we've done out of convenience here is we've made sure that all of the VMs that we give somebody has a port in common. And the port that I'm going to have on all my VMs is this 63173 port. So now I'm going to run the all pairs ping program, and I'm going to tell it, it takes as an argument what port it should use. And so I'm going to tell it to use port 63173. Okay, let's see here. Once again, this is my laptop going and connecting to all these machines. So if my connection is flaky, this is going to be bad. So two of the systems didn't start up in a timely period of time. The other six did. Let me list is a way of seeing the credentials. So one of them apparently didn't get the program. The other one just took a little while to start up. So now I'll go ahead and show you the ping matrix here. I'm going to grab one of these nodes at random, and I'm actually going to go and browse to 63173, I think it was. Was that right? Oops. And this is actually a web page that's being served by the program that I just deployed over HTTP. You'll notice if you look at one of the numbers and I hit refresh, that you'll notice that the numbers change. So this is a web page that dynamically updates itself. It is displayed entirely by my program that I've just gone in and shown you. Okay, so this is a demo. This is how easy it is for somebody who, you know, I just went into the website, registered. Within five to 10 minutes, I'm already running my code on machines all around the world. So this is how easy it is for you and your students to do things. Okay. Hold on. Let me jump back to where I was. Okay, and we have a bunch of educational resources and other things on our website. We have example assignments that have been used by different classes and things like that, vetted materials, we have tutorials, stuff like that, so it's really easy to get up and going with this. One other thing I'd just very briefly like to say, this all pairs ping program that I ran, this is the entire source code, everything, libraries, the whole thing is right here. It's about 50 lines of code. If you're wondering what those 50 lines of code are, to send periodic pings, check the timing, set timers and timeouts and things like that. It's 20 or so lines of code. Formatting the web page and speaking HTTP to my web browser is about another 20 lines of code. And there's like 15 lines of code where we initialize it. So you can do quite remarkable things in very few lines of code with this. Okay, so now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk briefly about the incentive-based scheme and incentives in our talk and end-user opt-in. So does anybody have any quick question about what I just showed you before I do that? Yes? An internal node? Right. Okay. So there's several questions or there's several sub answers to that question. One of which is I'm going to answer a slightly different question that's related, which is how do we handle nodes that are behind a NAT? Okay. And what we have is it's not in our current production version, but our beta version has a NAT traversal service built into it. So we actually have a bunch of nodes that we can tell that are, you know, trying to run our software that are behind NATs. And it's just that we're extremely careful with any code we put into production use because we're running this on people's real systems that they're using all around the world. So it's still in testing. We haven't finished it. I would expect that our next release, which will be out in about 3 weeks or so, will include support for tunneling through NATs. But we have had it, and we have been playing with it for some time. We're just trying to make sure there's no issues. Anyone else? Yes. Currently we have you get a 4-hour lease period. I can go and actually, if I decide I don't want these resources anymore, I can just go here and I can either remove them one at a time or I can just click remove all, which will turn those resources back in, and then I can go and get more. So if I didn't like these computers for some reason, I can do this. I don't have them anymore, and I can now say, okay, I want, instead of WAN nodes, I want 4 nodes that are together on a LAN. And then this will go and then find those computers and give them to me. Once again, it's a 4-hour period. One of the things we're probably going to add soon is a renew button. If you want to keep the same nodes, it's been more than 4 hours, you could go and click that. And so here I have a bunch of nodes that all are at least, you know, look like they're on the same LAN because they have the same first 3 octets of the IP address. Okay. Anyone else have any questions about that? Okay, so I started to talk before about end user opt-in and incentives. So we think that if we just got the altruistic sort of SETI at home users, we could grow this to a pretty reasonable size. But we think that will take a while. It's going to sort of limit our adoption. And we'd really like to have faster adoption, of course, controlled adoption. We don't want, I think Matt had an excellent point where he said you don't want to grow too big too fast. And we're very, very cognizant of that. We've actually had to caution people who are telling us that they're going to go and run this on, 1,000 machines and stuff like that. That no, we're happy with about 1,200 right now. We're happy to grow slowly as instructors use it, but we don't want somebody to go and, fire it up on 10,000 machines and not tell us. So a rough plan for, and I should say this is sort of my personal view about this. My view may change. This isn't meant to reflect anybody else on the project and how they perceive things going. Going out, but the current plan that we're following is basically we're trying to get educational use and adoption so that we can do things like educators are really great at pointing out things that we could improve in our language and our support. They're really great at if we have any bugs or portability issues that we're not aware of, they're really good at pointing those out, and they're really good at helping us to refine our documentation and do things like that. So they give us a tremendous amount of benefits. They make the platform much more stable. They give us interesting resources that aren't already there. You won't see home nodes. You won't see nodes behind NATs and things like that on Planet Lab. You will see them with what we're doing. And then following that, when we have this set of resources that's fairly diverse, robust software, well documented, then we think this is going to be very attractive to people like open source developers, to researchers, to people like that, because as studies have shown, if you measure things on Planet Lab and then try and apply those in the real world, the results that you got on Planet Lab are not necessarily going to hold, because Planet Lab is not very representative of the internet as a whole. So we intend to be representative of the internet as a whole, and so therefore the results that you'd get on our platform, we believe would be better. The sorts of things that we focus on to make the platform more attractive to developers, and we've started to do this, are we want to make sure that the fidelity of measurements is very, very good. While students might not care if the ping latency is off by 10% or so, UDP ping latency is off by 10%, researchers very much probably will care. Also, students might not care so much about performance if their code runs a little slow or not, but open source developers certainly will. So we wanted to start to address those sorts of issues so it becomes more attractive to them. And finally, researchers and open source developers are going to build all kinds of really great applications. And this is going to appeal to grandma. And we really see grandma and users like her as the way to get ourselves to a million nodes. So for example, just a shameless plug for University of Washington, Mike Pytek, released BitTorrent, BitTyrant, a couple years ago, which is a better BitTorrent program, and it's had over 1 million downloads. He recently released OneSwarm, which is an improvement, a more private way of doing BitTorrent, and it's on pace to beat that. So, researchers and open source developers are really good at getting people to install things on their boxes and really good at getting them to use them. And so, one thing that we tried to think hard about is how we can have incentives all along the way. Why does grandma want to donate resources? Why does the developer want to include our framework in with what they're doing? And why do educators want to use us? So I think it's pretty clear why the educators want to use us. The developers get the ability to run and test code on machines that they otherwise wouldn't be able to. So as Matt pointed out very astutely, it would be great for developers to be able to run their beta version of code using a sort of copy of the traffic that would normally go out the production version, because that's a really excellent thing to do when you're trying to go and test a service that's deployed. And so we give them the ability to do that and other things, and grandma may want it because the beta version might be faster. And so if the beta version returns an answer before the production version, then maybe the, you know, grandma sees improved performance, or there are other services and things that, that the developer can provide that he's only willing to provide on an experimental basis. So our development focus so far, so what this graph is meant to represent is where we are spending our time in spinning up very specific, very new things for an individual community. It is not meant to represent that at some point we stop working on X, we stop working on Y. It's just meant to be, we are starting large new initiatives to try and make our platform more attractive to educators. We actually have an automatic grading system where you can go and click a button and it will go and deploy student code on EmuLab, run unit tests on it, and tell you the results. Because the internet is a really great thing to have students be able to play with when they're going to test and write their code, but it's a really bad thing for you to use when you grade student assignments. Because, you know, for all the same reasons, because the internet is very variable. You know, links come and go, packet loss rates change, things like that. And so it's really hard to get any sort of consistent feel for, you know, how good X versus Y is if you're running both of them on the internet. We're in about, I think we're in about month 8 now, so we're getting started with a lot of things sort of more targeted towards the developer community. Later on, we see ourselves pushing more to do things for specifically end users to make things more attractive to them so they have more control over how their resources are shared. Later on, we believe that this sort of ties into some of what Matt is trying to do. We're sort of speculating that administrators may want to have some sort of control over what the end boxes in their network may want to do. But this is very much in year 3, and we haven't really fleshed any of that out or started to think hard about it. Okay, briefly, the last talk we saw what I'm going to call wholesale opt-in. I think I stole this from Matt, from his paper that he gave, where he's looking more at ISPs or universities that are opting in to doing network-based interposition on user traffic. And what we're doing is different in that we're trying to get any individual who wants to be part of Genie to be able to be part of Genie. Anyone who wants to, no matter where they are, no matter what their network connectivity is, they can go and donate resources and join. This is all nhost software-based interposition. So this is basically, you know, either allowing researchers to go and run code on your box to do active measurements, or perhaps as part of a mechanism yet to be defined, they can funnel their traffic from their normal applications through the through programs that run inside these VMs. Okay, so this is sort of how I see end-user opt-in playing out. And once again, a lot of this stuff is a bit far in the future, and so this is speculative. You shouldn't assume that anything I tell you on these slides we haven't necessarily built. So everything else I've told you and talked to you about with respect to our educational-based platform is very real, it's very there, we'd love to have people use it. This stuff is vaporware, so keep that in mind. Now, one key thing that you have to remember about what we're building a software artifact. So that means that our software artifact may be specialized. And so the stakeholders have to value the mechanism because the Genie public license allows forking. And just in case there's anybody in here who hasn't heard the term or not really that familiar with it, what happens with a lot of open source projects is some group will say, this is really great, but there's this wart on it. And I don't like this wart. And they'll take the code base and they'll essentially remove the wart and redo it how they want to do it and redistribute it. And that's perfectly allowed. This happens with lots of big projects. And in many cases, in fact, the thing that has had the wart removed is much more popular than the original. So SVN is actually an example of this, and there are a bunch of others where they forked SVN, created a new version that people were really starting to like, and then the people who had the SVN name said, well, you know, we should really jump ship too. Okay? And this is actually a very scary thing to have happen from the Genie perspective, because if I'm trying to build a test bed for you guys to use, and I am no longer getting the resources because someone else is using a fork that, you know, they're not opting into our website, into our things like this, then you guys don't have access to those resources. So someone else ends up with a million node test bed, you know, and we end up with 1,200 nodes, or however many more we grow from where we are now. So the key stakeholders that we, I think, really need to worry about are the user and the developer. The other example that is often touted in this case is the person who provides the data. But I believe in this case that the person who provides the data is always going to be either the user or the developer. At least I don't envision a scenario where that isn't the case. So I only put user and developer up here. And very briefly, the sorts of things that users might want for opt-in is they might want to be able to control what type of experiments will run on their box. They might want to control which developers run experiments. They might want to control where traffic can be sent. So I have a student who's doing his honors thesis on a mechanism to make it so that the nodes in our test bed have, so that there's an optional a box you can check when you install, so that the nodes in our test bed can only send traffic to other nodes in the test bed. So all of the, this we believe will remove pretty much all of the Planet Lab concerns that they have where person X is DOSing me or person X sent me weird traffic, because it will all be between instances that are running our software. You may also want to control which traffic can be sent. So this, I think, gets to a lot of these IRB issues. You might want to be able to control, okay, yes, I can send some traffic through some research service, but if I do banking, I don't want this information to go through, or I don't want anything that I would have sent through Tor to go through, or whatever. The users may want the ability to dynamically add and remove services. So there may be something like RON or multipath routing or things like that, where the user might want the ability to turn this on and off, and maybe even the ability to control which applications' traffic get routed through these types of services. Finally, developers may want a whole bunch of controls. They may want to be able to control their experiments. Obviously, they need to control their experiments, to start things, stop things, update code. They may want to be able to control what their experiment interacts with. They may want to say that this experiment should not receive any outside traffic from any other program that tries to send it messages. It should only be able to talk to other instances of itself. You may want to be able to control how your experiment is composed with other services. This experiment can use the RON service if the user has this available, or it will not use the RON service. Developer may want to choose whether or not to utilize user services. And also, as I said before, you may want to be able to swap between versions of your slice, the production and beta version, and move traffic between one or the other. So quick summary. We have built a testbed Seattle. It safely uses donated resources. As new technology comes online and people have new devices, mobile phones, wireless routers, things like this, it's fairly simple for us to port to new platforms, and so we envision that our testbed is going to be staying current with the latest technology without the sort of significant hardware investments that the NSF has to spend to keep Genie up to date. And as of last month, we had over 1,200 computers running on hundreds of universities, six continents. I put those figures in there for a non-Planet Lab audience. You guys know we're already running on Planet Lab. We do have a bunch of end users and things like that. About a third of our WAN users are not at Planet Lab nodes. So it's very interesting from that standpoint. And in terms of end user opt-in, the key takeaways here are that it must appeal to developers and users. People must feel that it's easy, safe, and valuable. It has to have flexible controls with few restrictions, because the last thing that we would want with a project like this is to have it fork early on and to have a huge testbed built by somebody else where they're not going to let you guys play with it. So I have a URL here, and I'm happy to take any questions related to any of this. We are looking for educational use, so let me know.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, sure.
Think of me as the grandmother, and why individual end user like me, my role then is to join. It's simply to want to donate resources. Is that correct?
Well, so when you talk about it in the overall scheme of incentives, we believe that developers are going to be building great applications that grandma's going to want to use. Uh-huh. And so, you know, a developer is going to build some application that, for instance, will tell grandma when her network connectivity goes away, you know, what she needs to push the power button on. And this seems to be, you know, a big problem for a certain class of users. Do I reset my wireless router? Do I reset my cable modem? Do I reset my computer? What do I need to reboot, right? And so that might be one example application that grandma might be very interested in. And the developer for that application, you know, as part of the install process, may ask grandma kindly, you know, would you be so kind as to donate some spare computational resources on your machine to further networking research? And grandma might click yes.
So, I mean, I'm thinking of something like Skype?
Something like Skype, yes. So I'm going to try and repeat the question here. So you're thinking about something like Skype, and you don't know why people need a direct incentive for what?
I guess I'm just wanting to understand what the model of involvement is for the end user. It's obviously not something like Skype, where it's true you're donating some of your computer's processing time, but you know that there's a service you can draw on directly from time to time.
No. I do think Skype is a good example. So I'll explain this in the context of Skype, and then maybe this will become clearer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Skype is actually a great example, because with Skype, you're going to be forwarding your traffic through other users' machines.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is exactly the sort of thing that a developer might build on our platform.
Mm-hmm.
And they might have, for example, they might have two versions of Skype. They might have a Skype that doesn't do multiple paths, and they might have a version of Skype that does do multiple paths. And if grandma chooses to donate, then grandma's traffic will go through multiple paths, and so she'll have an easier time talking to her grandkids. But if she chooses to do the sort of single path route, then her, the quality of the calls and the other things like that will be degraded. And so grandma has an incentive to donate, even though she's using the Skype application either way.
All right, thanks.
Okay, sure.
Any other questions in the room here?
Yes.
Yes,
we do. We support, we have sort of a freak show of different OSs and hardware that we try and do all of our testing on. And we keep up to date with XP and Vista and, to a lesser degree, 2000. So we do support Windows machines. We have quite a few Windows machines that run our software, because a lot of labs tend to have Windows. So, yes, we do. Okay, so the question is our system kind of a cloud computing system? And I think the answer to that is yes, because the reason why I say that is because I've seen about 15 different press releases where companies claim to do cloud computing. It seems like almost everything's cloud computing. But more seriously, the answer to your question, we have an implementation actually of MapReduce that one of the students did as part of a class project who was working on our platform. And so we do have support for things like that. And we are actually interested, if you're teaching a class and you want to teach things like cloud computing, it's actually very accessible for a student on our platform to build the entire infrastructure for MapReduce in several, I would say over maybe three assignments in a class. And we thought about adding that as a set of course assignments, if you might be interested in doing that. We also do have the prepackaged version that runs if you're just interested in having your students run MapReduce programs. Although it is not production quality, it's a student's code for a project that kind of limps along. Okay. Anyone else? Yes?
Are you worrying in any ways now that people are much more conscious about the energy consumption of their computer?
Yes. So, The question is, are we concerned about people being worried about energy consumption for their computers, and how will that impact us? So we are targeting Hummer owners. If someone's first concern is energy consumption, then we, yes, that probably we're not necessarily the best fit. Although when we do run on mobile devices, I have looked to see what the battery difference is, and it isn't significantly worse. It's actually, I think, about 15 to 20% worse, which, considering we take 10% of the resources, isn't so bad. So. No. That's great. That's actually a good thing. So, I mean, if you get real user availability patterns. So, I mean, okay, there are probably students who are running their code on my machine right now. I just closed my laptop. Okay, so their programs are going to have to deal with this. If they wanted, you know, an environment where nothing bad ever happened, then Emulab or simulation would be what you want. But this is actually a valuable lesson. I mean, this is actually a valuable thing for students and programmers to learn, is that the real world has failures. The real world has unavailability, because they're sure as heck going to know it when they go to a company and try and write their first program that, you know, that does simple things. So, okay. Anyone else?
Thank you very much. All right.
Oh yes, you might need this.
Well, I think that's a great thing. We have proof that we have opt-in today. lastly, today I was going to do a very quick system engineering report, bring you up to date on the activities of the working group. So let's just launch in. Again, for those who may be new to opt-in, what is opt-in? We've been defining it by the use cases where end users, not researchers, become involved with Genie experiments. You just saw that, for example. And by the services and capabilities that are necessary to support them. So the idea, the use case, and the underlying mechanism. I'm the systems engineer, and I, for opt-in, also for control framework, and involved in other GPO activities. And our goals are to frame issues from the top down, synthesize things, and draft documents, which we're going to get to after a bit here. I want to talk about a little bit more on the definition of end-user opt-in, the working group activities and status right now, the things that we've been doing. We've defined five basic end-user cases. There are three basic capabilities. We've got projects underway. And very importantly, we're looking to write a first draft of an end-user opt-in overview document to put everything in one place so that people can see what we're doing. And finally, we would encourage you to participate. So again, we said GE end-user opt-in is defined by use cases and so forth, where users, end users, become involved. A particular situation that we're talking about here might involve more than one end use case. It might involve somebody opting in. We may worry about privacy, all of these things at once. Each end user opt-in use case involves a set of players, one or more underlying capabilities, unique issues, policies, and best practices. And I think Matt's and Justin's talk have walked you through that in two different situations. As I said, we've defined these five basic end-user cases and the underlying capabilities that are required to support them. I'm going to go through the capabilities very quickly here. Capability number one is a gateway from Genie to another network like the internet. And we have two active Spiral 1 projects on virtual tunnels and regional opt-in that are working on those things. Capability 2 is putting a user's node into the system, and Justin just explained the Million Node Genie project. And capability 3 is the function of collecting experimental data and logs where some might be user identifiable. And again, that's being covered to some extent in the measurement system that's being developed as part of Spiral 1. And the Spiral 1 projects, the view of all the projects, which you saw at the last GEC, the highlighted ones here are the ones that involve end-user opt-in. You can see they're here and there in the Spiral 1 universe. The opt-in use cases that we've been talking about are numbered 1 through 5 here. Number one, opt into a Genie experiment for service. And we had a workshop last year organized by Craig Partridge that brought people together to define these things, talked about users and applications being together. Sounds also like the Million No Genie project. Case two is the wholesale opt-in of traffic. Matt talked about that. I think this is still the most challenging thing that the Genie opt-in could do. On the other hand, we had a security workshop at UC Davis a while ago, and there's several researchers who say, boy, if I can get traffic into Genie, I can finally analyze things, real traffic. They don't have access to that today. It would be an enormous boon to a lot of researchers in the Genie world. Case three is sort of the mirror image of opt-in. It's when something in the Genie world disturbs things outside. So you involve somebody outside who didn't want to be involved. And we've had talks at last GEC and some other things from Larry Peterson, who has a lot of experience in the Planet Lab world of those things happening. And so again, in all situations, we have to be cognizant that when we have people opt in or we do things, we can be affecting others unintentionally. Use case four, the opt-in of user resources. We talked about that. And use case five is gathering data involving opt-in users and figuring out what to do with that. It's private in many cases. Can it be made anonymous or not? We've found some very good references lately, and we've gotten some other people involved that I think can give us some guidance of how to handle that. This is not a new problem in networking research, and it's been thought through pretty well. So our next goal is to take all these things, these five use cases, the capabilities, put them in an overview document that we hope to draft within the next month or two. For each use case, we want to add more detail, better understand the players and relationships, clearly identify and define key issues, formulate proposed policies and best practices, try to specify the required capabilities a little better, and again, include the referencing of various implementations and research that's already been done. Finally, Helen identified for us the idea of looking among all these policies and for policy themes, things that we could gather together which says, okay, this kind of situation, obviously privacy is one, obviously other issues that span different legal jurisdictions is another, those kinds of themes we ought to pull out and study more carefully. And we expect a draft document soon, I would say within a couple of months, which we can then review with the working group. Last, a quick view of how you can participate in the working group. I'd certainly encourage you to check the wiki for activities, announcements, draft documents, references. Absolutely, please join the mailing list if you're not on it. Once you do that, you can participate in discussions and reviews of documents more easily. And actually, once you're on the list, you can contribute to the wiki. You can put your material there as well. And last but not least, attend meetings and interact with the community. So that's my quick overview of where we are in the working group. Are there any general questions here? So Helen and Henning are perhaps still on the line, our working group chairs. Any last words?
No, this has just been very interesting for me, and thanks to the speakers.
So Helen is thanking the speakers, and I'd like to thank them too. I think both are very interesting and examples of what's going on with opt-in today. Okay, thank you.